evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, May 7, 2019. The Transitional Government of National Unity may not be formed on time. That's according to officials in Juba.
By the 12th of this month, that will be already almost going to 5-6 months. Training, for example, when the unified forces are going to be trained, will it take a week? Will it take 3 months?
And a South Sudanese analyst who visited Yei recently disputes the claim that Yei is peaceful.
Yeah, so I spoke with displaced people from a few villages that are outside Yei and the area, and those ones said that basically government troops that entered their area, they accused the government troops of looting houses, of burning some houses.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Officials sitting on the pre-transitional committee say delays in cantoning and training unified army will delay the formation of the transitional government of national unity. SPLM-IO officials say the parties should discuss extending the deadline so security arrangements are completed before a new government is formed. Onen Walter Solomon reports for VOA from Gulu, northern Uganda.
In about 2 months, the 8-month pre-transitional period ends. The former warring parties are supposed to form a transitional government by May 12 under the revitalized peace deal signed last year. Martin Elia Lomoro, South Sudan Cabinet Affairs Minister and Secretary of the Pre-Transitional Committee, says a lack of money is hindering efforts to canton fighters from the various groups, train them and create a unified force. He says before a new transitional government is formed, a unified force must be in place.
That is a condition for the establishment of the transitional government. Without that force, the transitional government will not be formed. And this is important to all the parties to the agreement, that it is important for us to move our forces expeditiously, to assemble them and move them in cantonment so that within the next 3 months, we can form that unified force.
Henry Odua, the NPTC co-chairman and deputy head of the SPLM-IO, agrees.
By the 12th of this month, that will be already almost going to 5-6 months. Training, for example, when the unified forces are going to be trained, will it take a week? Will it take 3 months? Thereafter, because we think that some of the forces, either from the government side or from the opposition side, they will be left out after the unification. And that poses a lot of problems.
Odua says the lack of funds to complete security arrangements on time may lead to the formation of a government which collapses. He is urging members of the NPTC to handle the security arrangement carefully to protect the next government from a repeat of what happened in July 2016.
The way it is that the principals have to sit down, find out the time required for completing the security arrangements, and then extend the deadline to the end of that time. Do we need 2 months for security arrangements to be finished? Do we need 3 months, 5 months?
The number of states and their boundaries must also be resolved before the new transitional government is formed. Lomoro says delays in resolving those issues are likely to delay formation of the new government as well.
We're waiting for results of the Technical Border Commission to determine some of the tribal boundaries, and then the IBC, the Independent Border Commission, that would determine the number and the boundaries of the states. We're waiting again to move forces physically to cantonment sites. The time that we had expected for these two committees to work has expired.
Odua says the opposition believes that all the parties should meet around a table now to find a compromise on the number of states and an agreement on their boundaries.
Do we go back to the 10 states and allow South Sudanese to decide how many states we want to during the transitional period? Or should we go along with the former colonial districts? Because then we did not have problems. And so those boundaries could be used to form the 21 states, or we can go with the additional 2 or 3 former districts so that we can even reach up to 24 states.
The revitalized peace deal states that if the Independent Boundaries Commission fails to resolve the dispute over the number of states, the matter would be decided by referendum. Odwa says the SPLM-IO does not trust the government to organize a credible referendum.
The referendum will be conducted under the current incumbent government, and it will still have the president at the head, his governors, his commissioners, and his police, or rather the whole security arrangement will still be under him.
Odwa says under that scenario, the chances of rigging the outcome are, in his words, very, very high. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Gulu, northern Uganda.
Still on peace matters, an American nonprofit called Water is Basic says local peace-building initiatives by the church in Yei River State is making progress. Steve Rouse says some rebels of the National Salvation Front signed a deal in Yei Town. But some analysts say the deal was signed by some individuals who don't represent the National Salvation Front.
I think we heard the exact same thing when we were working on grassroots peace, and members of SPLAIO were signing peace agreements in several states. And then the word was, well, RIOC is not there, so how can it be real? And I would just respond to that, well, RIOC is not there, and he hasn't been there for a long time. The same is true of Thomas Cirillo. I'm not sure if anybody knows where he is, but we do know where his generals in the bush are, and they have come out, and they have signed, and they've laid down their weapons and said, we're not fighting anymore. We have a website called South Sudan Now where we have documents that those folks signed, including a letter from one of his generals who said, hey, here's what I thought was going to happen with NAS. Here's what I see happening, and I'm out. We want to seek peace with the government and go forward. So the idea that every single person of a group is going to be at a peace signing, I think, is somewhat naive. But when the forces that are on the ground creating the conflict come in and sign, I think that's great hope for the future.
How are you supporting the people on the ground to realize that there's peace in South Sudan, or in Yei for that case?
We provide awareness and funding, but the work is really being done by Archbishop Elias Taban and Evangelical Presbyterian Church Peace Desk that is based in Yei River State. They are doing the ones that are bringing people together. We'll provide funding for charter flights to bring soldiers out of the bush, etc. But they're the ones bringing them together, sitting them down, and letting them express their grievances, and then formalize them and sign them. And then the government, including this last agreement, Dr. Martin came in for the signing, etc. That's how that process goes. Now, letting people know about it, that's an interesting part. There is a radio station that we broadcast from in Yei called EPC Radio, reaches into Uganda and into Congo, and we are broadcasting on a weekly basis messages about peace and reconciliation and trauma healing, but also the message that peace has been signed. My experience is word of mouth moves very quickly when people want to get home. And we're seeing people respond very quickly when they hear that there's security in Yei. And I think it won't be long, but now that this peace agreement has been signed with these rebel soldiers, that you'll see a much faster movement back into Yei River State and into other areas in South Sudan.
And how is your interaction with people? I mean, you know, since the conflict broke out in 2013 and moving to 2015, there were quite some quarters from within the government that were sending messages that it seems like America is looking for a regime change in South Sudan. And at one point, there was a huge demonstration in Juba, specifically, you know, with slogans condemning the United States. How do you feel whenever you go to South Sudan?
My interaction is great. You know, the word on the street is that you cut Steve and he bleeds South Sudan blood. I find the people to be adventuresome, resilient, strong, hardworking. Everyone has been traumatized. We must do something, and we're working on a program to do as much as we possibly can in the area of trauma healing across the whole nation. But I see people as hopeful, and they love their country. They love their plot of land. They love what they can grow on that land, and they love eating the product of their own hand. I find the people still love America and are very hopeful that America will be a long-term friend, as it has been in the past, in the future as this country builds.
That's Steve Rousey, president of the American non-profit Water is Basic. He was speaking to me from the southern city of Dallas, Texas, last week. A senior South Sudan analyst at the International Crisis Group says families displaced by fighting in Yei River State are saying the government of South Sudan have looted their property and burned their villages. Alan Boswell says the situation in the outskirts of Yei town remains dire. He says several local peace initiatives by a non-profit operating in Yei has failed to stop the violence in the state.
Well, Yei town itself is somehow calm, but when you go outside Yei, the situation is a lot more grim. People who have been fleeing from the bush say that there was a government offensive taking more territory. That is since mid-January that started. And so you have a lot of villagers and have come to Yei. There's also, as UNHCR reported, a lot of refugees who fled down to the Congo area.
And the fighting in Yei is between who and who? I mean, I know that the government has been saying they are battling rebels in Yei, but I mean, who are these rebels?
Yeah, of course, they're people who are loyal to Thomas Cirillo. I mean, some of these forces used to be loyal to Riek Machar and SPLA-IO. Now they call themselves the NAS forces. But it's also important to remember that not all these civilians are fleeing because of fighting. In some cases, they're just fleeing because the South Sudanese army entered their village, and so they left.
Did you get an opportunity to speak with the elders there, community leaders, or, you know, members of the residents in Yei town? Did you get time to speak with them? And if so, what were they telling you?
Yeah, so I spoke with displaced people from a few villages that are outside Yei and the area. And those ones said that basically government troops had entered their area. They accused the government troops of looting houses, of burning some houses, and generally being abusive towards the civilians. And then they fled. They also said that, of course, there was NAS forces in that area. From the people who I spoke to hadn't witnessed any battles. It was like the rebels had pulled back before the government forces had showed up. There's also a lot of, you know, if you're a young man in Yei, you're under a lot of pressure from the rebel groups to join them, and you're under a lot of pressure from the, from the government as well. So it's not a situation where the government's the only one to blame. I think the rebel forces also are sometimes blocking civilians from coming to Yei town, and they also pressure the young men to join their groups. But what I'd say is the recent uptick in violence is definitely far more related to the government choosing to launch an offensive.
And how about some local initiative by non-governmental organizations in the area trying to build peace? We understand that there was a peace agreement signed in Yei between NAS rebels and the government. Did you hear about that?
I did hear about that. You know, this isn't the first time this happened. There was also a peace deal that the local Yei government championed with the same NGOs. This was a couple years ago, and they claimed that these were at that time IO commanders, and of course these were guys who really didn't command any forces. So they were brought in, they recruited some more guys, and then they've been integrated, but of course the rebellion didn't stop, and I think we'll see the same thing this time, where they found a few people who are willing to call themselves NAS. They don't come with significant troops, and the war will continue. So unfortunately, these sorts of peace-building strategies don't have a good track record.
What is your overall reading of the situation in Yei River State? Do you see peace coming back to the area?
I mean, unfortunately, as the ceasefire has set in the rest of the country, Yei looks like the place right now that's being left behind. I think, you know, and as an organization, as Crisis Group, we're definitely calling there to be dialogue rather than fighting in order to resolve this. It's important to remember that both NAS and the government were signatories to the 2017 cessation of hostilities. And so it would be good if IGAD and others tried to get both parties to recommit to that and then engage in dialogue rather than taking it back to war. you know, sometimes these counterinsurgencies, they can backfire where they fuel the rebellion even further. And I fear that's what might happen in Ye.
That's Alan Boswell, a senior South Sudan analyst at the International Crisis Group. He spoke with me from Nairobi earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese women leaders call on their government to end gender-based violence. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how has technology impacted your life?
When I want information, I just pick my phone. I just go to Google, and all the information that I want, I get it just right where I stand.
It made me to be so social to people, like on Facebook. I've known so many people, knowing how they are going on in life, and also on WhatsApp, chatting with my friends.
It's educative to me as well, because if I need to know something about history, something about a disease, something about some medicine, I just go and read about it online.
When I need information, I don't necessarily have to go to the library. All I need to do is just pick up my tablet and I Google whatever I want to know about whilst in the comfort of my home.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Ahead of the International Women's Day, South Sudanese women leaders are calling on the government to end sexual and gender-based violence across South Sudan. Winnie Chirino has this report for VOA from Juba.
The women made the call during a panel discussion today, sponsored by the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, focusing on the role of women in South Sudan's peace process. ANMI's Police Commissioner Unai Silutu says women have borne the brunt of the conflict in South Sudan because they are frequently sexually assaulted by both government and rebel forces. Lutu says ANMI's will work with the Kiir administration to end sexual violence and ensure that perpetrators are punished.
We continue with the United Nations agencies, funds and programs in supporting the national institution to expand the justice system in the form of mobile courts that are now moving on to other states in order that they can also see the ends of justice in the cases that are reported, especially in the sexual and gender and the gender-based violence. So some of these cases have gone through the court.
Teresa Siricio, head of the opposition SANU party, says women want fair representation in government.
Peace absolutely is linked among men and women. Therefore, the creation of the culture of peace will not be possible if it's not clear that the exercise of power inside the social, political, economic, military, or the various security structures and organizations continue to be male-dominated.
Adjonye Papecha, acting chairperson of the South Sudan Law Society, says women have suffered for far too long and must play a role in the peace process so that they can help shape South Sudan's future.
Fair representation by the right people. They need also their own system space so that they deliver well for this country. Another thing is in some of the institutions, they would wish transparency and accountability, especially Minister of Finance, they would wish to take it over so that they manage this country.
Jemani Nkumba, Acting Secretary General for SPLM, agrees that many women possess outstanding leadership skills but rarely get appointed to leadership positions. She encourages women who want to hold political positions to join the political parties in the country. Kumba says it's important for women to create forums to discuss their issues.
How many women are there in government? Very few. But even if you are not there, you still have a role to make sure that you monitor. You monitor the implementation and raise issues that are not implemented properly.
Lona James, head of the Center for Women Leadership at the Catholic University of South Sudan, says the civil war has mainly affected women and children who are vulnerable. She says only a small number of women contribute to the peace process because most South Sudanese women have little knowledge of their rights, and the ones that do are often threatened.
A high level of insecurity and personal threats for women participating in official peace negotiations remains to be a problem. Inadequate political will both for international and regional and national organization and mediation teams that promote and include women as local informal mediators and our capacities for peace.
The campaign theme for Friday's International Women's Day is Balance for Better. It is a worldwide event that celebrates women's achievements and calls for gender equality. It's a day that has been celebrated since the early 19s and strives to bring together women's organizations, governments, and charities. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serena in Juba.
The International Labour Organization reports the work and gap and pay gender gap remains wide, and only strong policies and laws that are implemented will change this situation for better. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from ILO headquarters in Geneva, where the agency has launched a new report called A Quantum Leap from Gender Equality for Better Future of Work for All, ahead of the International Women's Day.
When it comes to getting a job, women lag far behind men. The International Labour Organization finds the needle on this has hardly moved over the past 27 years. It says 26% fewer women than men are likely to be employed. It says this also extends to women in top jobs. ILO data show globally that just one quarter of managers or leaders are women. It says women who make it to the top tend to be 1 year younger and better educated than their male counterparts. Despite these qualifications, authors of the study say women do not draw the same salary for the same top job done by men. Globally, the study finds the gender wage gap remains at an average of 20%. Shauna Olney is chief of the ILO Gender, Equality, and Diversity branch. She says mothers of young children up to age 6 have the lowest chance of being employed.
The motherhood employment penalty has increased over the past 10 years by 38%. So again, something is not going right. This is going in the wrong direction. There's also a motherhood leadership penalty, as only 25% of managers with young children are women, and women's share in managerial positions rises to 31% when they don't have children.
Olney tells VOA the work done by women in leadership roles tends to be underrated. When it comes to job performance, she says women tend to be praised for their so-called soft skills, for their ability to communicate and relate well with people.
I think the fact that we call them soft shows they're undervalued. They're not the hard skills. They're not the serious stuff. They're soft. So why should we pay for them? Why should we give them any value? So I think there's a lot of biases, and the evidence is very clear there, in terms of how we evaluate what women and men do.
The report advocates certain measures to accelerate the pace of change in achieving gender parity. It calls for strong laws and policies that prohibit discrimination in the workplace and promote equality of treatment, opportunity, and outcome. It recommends supporting women through work transitions and giving them a greater voice and representation in regard to labor matters. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Cameroon, 82 couples have taken part in a mass wedding ceremony as part of efforts to better protect the legal rights of women. Only 10% of marriages in Cameroon are legalized, leaving wives with few rights. The mass wedding ceremony is part of activities to mark Friday's International Women's Day, as Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from northern Cameroon town of Marao.
Traditional Cameroonian dancers perform in the courtyard of the Marua Town Council. They are celebrating the official marriage of 82 couples, most of them Muslims. Among the couples is 16-year-old Asta Ismaila and her 47-year-old husband.
J'ai été survivante de mariage précoce et forcé à l'âge de 14 ans.
Ismaila says she was forced to be the man's third wife when she was barely 14 years old. After giving birth, she says her husband did not take care of her or her baby. Although the couple split last year, they agreed to legalize their marriage so Ismaila and their child would not be shunned by the community. It also provides mother and child with important and rare legal protection. Cameroon's Institute of Statistics says only 10% of couples have legalized their marriage, relying instead on simple traditional ceremonies. If the man dies, his family members often take the couple's property and send the woman away with nothing. The Cameroon Association of Lawyers Hamadou Hamajaru says with a legal marriage, the state protects the wife's property rights.
La peine privative de liberté va de 3 mois à 1 an.
He says Cameroon's penal code punishes anyone who forces a widow out of her marital home with a prison term of 3 months to 1 year and a fine of $100 to $1,000. If the woman is pregnant or violence is used, the sentence can be from 2 to 5 years in prison. In northern Cameroon's polygamous Muslim communities, men often bring home an additional wife without consulting the current ones. Without a registered marriage, the wives have few legal options to challenge the man's decision. Aissa Dumara is coordinator of the Association for the Fight Against Violence on Women and Girls. She says women who defy their husband, legally or not, are often abused or kicked out of the house.
Au courant de l'année, nous avons reçu plus de 35 cas.
She says only 35 of the 351 abused women who sought their help in 2018 were legally married. Dumara says they were forced at very young ages into the homes of men who promised to marry them, but instead they were battered, forced to do difficult domestic work, or simply dismissed. The group arranged Wednesday's mass wedding for International Women's Day to educate women to legally marry. It's no small challenge in Cameroon's remote villages. Ismaila tried to convince her husband's 2 other wives to legalize their marriages as well. But they said their families were against it because the husband and his family had yet to pay them money or property for the marriage known as bride price. The cost for the wives having no legal protection could prove to be much higher. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Marwa, Cameroon.
From Marwa, Cameroon, we move to Kenya with the song Nyamachoma by Sam Mapangala. We have been listening to Sam Pangala with the song Nyama Choma. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.